Good afternoon. So today I'm going to do exam review. So I will take topics you'd like me to talk about. If there are topics which aren't mentioned, we won't talk about them. So I'll just take them, and when I have what I think is the set, I'll put them in some order and go over them. So what things would you like me to talk about? Yeah. And since I don't have the prior exams memorized, could you tell me what that's roughly about?
It's about mapping program accesses to physical addresses.
Accesses to physical addresses, okay.
See how many addresses you can get from
CCode. CCode, okay.
Code optimizations and the inefficiency they're addressing.
Can you be more specific?
What is loop unrolling supposed to accomplish?
Okay.
But also function inlining. I know there are four main ones that are mentioned.
Rolling, function inlining are good when. Okay. Other thing? Yes.
Virtual memory access when there's multiple levels.
Look up. Okay. I thought I saw someone else over there. Yeah.
TLB hit versus miss.
Versus miss. Okay. Anything else? This is all we have. Anything? Okay. Number 8 of what?
Of the most recent.
So spring 28. Also, I do not have the prior exams memorized. So you need to tell me what the question's basically about. So I can figure out when I talk about it. Which is to send up.
It's about vector instructions.
Vector instructions, okay. Yeah. Okay. Vector instructions in general. Okay.
Forwarding.
Okay. Anything more specific or just?
Also stalling and multi.
Okay. That's not more specific. It's more general, but okay. Any other topics? Yeah.
Page table entry sizes and page table sizes based off of
page table sizes, PTE sizes, etc. That's
Based on the amount of space that the virtual memory has.
Versus so virtual address layout. Anything? Let's open a new window, and I should have realized I would need to pull up the exam. But let's sort these. So I'll go in a rough order. Forwarding and stalling. So forwarding is the idea that, so first of all, we have a hazard. So a data hazard. Data hazard is pipeline naturally reads the wrong version of a value. So this generally happens when we have something like, say, rex does fetch decode right back, and let's say we do an add queue, RAX, RAX. This add queue, this is when add queue naturally reads RAX versus when the when IRMove queue naturally writes. So the issue is that this add queue is supposed to get the instruction from the IRMove queue, but if we don't do anything, that this doesn't happen naturally in our pipeline, because remember that this is time is going this way, that when the add queue would normally read the value of RAX, it's not the value that IRMove queue has written, because IRMove queue doesn't write till the write back stage. We can't just have IRMove queue write earlier, because there might be other instructions that are using the register file to write at the same at those earlier times. So you have to wait. But for something like IRMove queue, it's pretty obvious that the value 100, you know, we don't need to do any work, special work to get it. We just need to know where is that value 100, and that's what forwarding is. So forwarding, so, you know, if we do nothing, wrong answer. So forwarding says the value 100 is available. Let's use it. So with forwarding, we're going to take the value, let's use it, and shortcut the value from IRMove queue's execute to add queue's decode. Most likely in this case, to use it. And the implementation is need to check that IRMove queue instruction is writing to the same register that addQueue is reading from in your HCL code, something like we check like edest e equals reg source A with source A reg source B, which B also yeah, so you check some condition like that to know that this was a thing that you could do, because you know, need to distinguish from something like this. You don't want to forward and to use 100 in that case, that would be wrong. So that's the basic idea of what forwarding is. So stalling is, you know, is the generic solution to hazards, which is that, well, if we did everything one at a time, it would work correctly. So we can delay the operation to make it work, to get the right answer. So if we were just using stalling, so only using stalling, we'd take something like this add queue, and we'd say, okay, fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. Well, I need to wait for this write back to finish before I can read, so I'll do that. So I'll just delay actually finishing, letting the fetch finish and move on until I'm actually done with the write. And sometimes forwarding is not enough, but adding stalling can always fix a hazard, always fix a data hazard. And, or a, you know, a hazard in general. Yeah?
Can you give an example of stalling for the load use hazard?
So the load use hazard, is that where we load a value and then we need to use an execute next, and this doesn't work naturally. So an example is if I do pop qrax and then add rax rax, we have this timeline, and the value we get from popq is available at near the end of the memory stage. And if we just do our add naturally, we'd want to do this, but here this doesn't work. So work. So if we do, so if we solve with stalling only, we'd end up with a solution like this, where we wait for the add to write the value back before we try to read it. If we solve with stalling and forwarding, we're just going to wait until long enough that the value will be ready by the time we need to add it. So the time we need to add it is that we want to execute immediately after the value is ready. Execute is where we actually do the addition. We definitely have to have the value then. And I can align things up this way, and we'll forward the value to the end of the code, replacing what we'd read from the register 5. And this ends up being one cycle of stalling. With our 5-cycle processor, if we had a different set of pipeline stages, we'd have a different amount of stall. Yes? Question, it doesn't matter what stage we stall. As far as effects, no. Obviously, like, the HCL code would be different, but we can, but if we have, for example, REX, add queue, REX, REX, and like some irrelevant instruction, we could execute this as W, we could execute this like this, and have our this, or, you know, so this is the multiple equivalent options, or we could do it as you suggest in the code stage, in which case everyone has, we just don't, make sure we don't forget about instructions, and that's going to be the same. The HCL code is going to be different. The values of pipeline registers will be different, but the effect as far as when things actually finish is the same. And it might be easier to implement the second option because of when you're doing the check that the register numbers match and where you have to do it. And again, in all these pictures, time goes this way. Okay, so other questions about, yes?
On the exam, would we have to worry about a problem like this, but like with it being able to do out of order instructions?
So when you have to worry about a problem like this with out of order instructions, we won't talk about forwarding with out of order, the details of forwarding with out of order instructions beyond that it obviously happens. And that, you know, we'll usually assume that forwarding without a order instructions just works. That if we can figure out if the value is available, it's forwarded. Because we didn't talk about what the real implementation of that looks like. But we expect you to know, like, conceptually, what order can an out of order processor execute things in, and which is basically whenever the values are available, it will figure out how to forward things. Or at least potentially can. Okay, other questions? Okay, so counting cache misses from C code. So you want to, for this, so this should be the same as, you know, the C code is just specifying a list of addresses that are accessed, typically with a pattern, because loops create patterns, because they have, like, doing the same thing over and over again, with a pattern that should help identify what, you know, what goes on more quickly. So from a conceptual point of view, solving this problem, the C code problem, is the same as if we gave you a list of addresses. You just need to figure out what are the addresses we're accessing. And a good rule of thumb for, you know, what addresses, you know, generally shouldn't matter much whether you know, array is at address 0 versus 1024 versus so on, so long as aligned with cache blocks. Right. As long as the array like starts at the beginning of a cache block, so we don't have to worry about like array elements being split across two cache blocks or divided up, or that division being different, and we'll probably try to specify this in problems where it matters. It doesn't really matter the exact address. It shouldn't change the performance much. You're just like shifting where you are in the rows of the cache. So you can just make up a convenient address and you would expect roughly the same performance, or probably exactly the same performance, because you're just moving all your index bits one forward with wrap around. It's gonna give you the same answer as far as number of hits, number of misses. Just the set indexes will all be, instead of 0, 1, 2, 3, they'll be 1, 2, 3, 4, and then, and so on. Okay, and for figuring out cache misses, so my general piece of advice is you can look at each cache set separately. So that's something that can help. So usually, so often different loop iterations, values of I, et cetera, access completely different cache sets. Cache sets can just consider iterations that might access the same set. So you can divide up the loop iterations by set, and often you'll find that there's a relatively small number of iterations for each set. And often patterns mean that all access sets see that most sets have same hit miss pattern. Loop means. Just because if you're doing something for element 1, element 2, 3, 4, it's gonna do the same thing to the cache sets that are represented, that are responsible for index 1, 2, 3, 4. So just consider what iterations might access the same set, and there's two important ways which can happen. Sometimes you'll access the same block repeatedly, same element of some array, or adjacent elements of array which have same index bits. E.g., if you have 32 byte cache blocks, array 0 is at the beginning of a block, then array 0 through array and size of array 0 is, let's say, 4. Then array 0 through array 4 times. 8 through array 7 are in the same block. And sometimes you'll access different blocks that use the same set. And here you have to worry about conflicts. How many ways are there for the set? So for example, array 0, if you have 1024 sets of 32 byte blocks, then elements that map to the same set are 1024 times 32 bytes apart. One way you can see this is that there are 32 log base 2 of 32 offset bits, log base 2 of 1024 index bits. So for index plus offset bits not to change, need to add 2 to the offset plus index bits to a value and that means that those things will map to the same set or multiples of that. Yeah, or I should say multiples of. Does that make sense? Because we have we keep advanced by that much. One way of looking at it is you wrap around in the cache. The other way of looking at it is when you add that much, you're not changing any of those lower bits. So they always go to the same set. But you'll generally have this pattern. It's due to the, log 232 plus log 2 and that's 24. Equal, and this 1024 times 32 is the number of bytes in a way. And that's not a coincidence. Another way of thinking about it is as you go down in a way, eventually you wrap around, and you do that depending on how many bytes are in a way. A way is, remember, one column of a cache when we have multiple ways. Okay, and so for access, and then when you figure out what access is the same set, look at the order accesses are in for each set, and figure out what the contents of the set is. So typically at any, so for example, the simplest case, if it's a direct map cache, set contains only what was last accessed. So if you're trying to access what you last accessed from the set, it's a hit, otherwise it's a miss. For an N-way cache, set contains N things, which ones depend on the replacement policy. So if the replacement policy is least recently used, they contain the N most recently accessed things. If it's something else, you'll have to look at the rule of the replacement policy to figure out what goes on. So did I go over what people were looking for in that? Yeah.
Can you do an example of that? So.
So let's say we have this and array given in, let's say, int array 28. And we have a direct mapped 16K cache. So let's consider what sets we access. So we're accessing direct mapped 16K cache, and let's say we have 8 byte blocks. And that's wonderful. Okay, so in this case, and this is probably a hard example because I usually try to make my examples not ridiculously bad. So in this case, we can consider that we have two different things we're accessing here that overlap. We have this first one, which I'll call A, and the second one, which I'll call and I inadvertently made this really hard. Because we have to worry about reading and writing. But we'll say a write through, write no allocate, because that turns out to matter. So in this case, we access for A, our access pattern is we access set 0. During when I equals 0 and 1, we access set 0, and then we never access set 0 again. When I equals 2 and 3, we access set 1. So, right, another assumption I should specify is array and let's say starts at beginning of cache block. So you don't have to worry about the elements being part of two different cache blocks or anything like that. So array zero and one is set zero and so on. So this is the pattern of what set numbers we see for A. Is that we have this 5, set 1, 2, all the way up to I equals 1022, 1023, which maps to set 1022 divided by 2 equals 511. So does that part make sense? So I'm just dividing them up by set. And for B, we know when I equals 0, we access set 0. And the same is true if we think about I times, oh, right, yeah, I times 128 and 4 times 4, yeah, okay. Same is true when we access something which is going to be a multiple of 16k apart. So 16k bytes is 4k ints. So when we're accessing multiples of 4k that are plus 0, that's going to be the same set. So array 0 and array 4k, array 8k, see, are all set 0. So if we look at I times 128, when we multiply 4k divided by 128, which is 32, that's going to map to set 0, k, and same with 64 is array 8k, and so on. So those all map to set 0, does that make sense? And all the way, you know, up to every 32. 2, 2, and when I equals 1, and 33, which is array 128 plus 4k, 65, and dot, dot, that, and so on, that's going to map to set 64, and when I equals 2, and 34, and 66, it's going to map to set 128, and so on. Does this make sense, how I'm figuring this out? I'm taking a bit of a shortcut for time. Yeah.
How do you get set 64 and 7?
So 64, because I have 128 ints in, so 64, so this is array of 128 is 128 ints into from the beginning, or 128 times 4, which is 1024 bytes from the beginning. Bytes from the beginning, or 1024 divided by 8 equals, I hope, 64, or else I made an error. It's 128 because I can't do math. Okay. Well, that shouldn't be right. No, it should be 64. 128 times 4 is, okay. 128 times 4 is 512. And 512 bytes from the beginning is set 64. That make sense? Yeah. And I know the other indices are the same. And that's, get that back. And so on. And we see we have this periodic pattern. And now to figure out how many cache misses there are, we have, you know, so counting misses, we have two cases. So we have sets 0, 64, 128, and so on. We have to worry about, there's two places we access them. And sets, and accesses to set 1, 2, 3, you know, all other sets, we have only one case to worry about. So for set 0, we have the special case of when I equals 0, we have something weird going on, where if we look at this loop, I equals 0, we access set 0 multiple times. So we're going to say that we have definitely at least 2 misses, and maybe 3, depending on how many times we access array of I. So I equals 0, 0 set 0 is 3 misses, 2 or 3 misses. I guess 2 misses, because I said write through, write no allocate. Assuming we don't count that as a write miss. Misses plus accesses to 64, for set 64, we access it when I equals, oh, right. I gave a boring example. No, I didn't. Okay. Yeah. For set 64, we access it first when I equals, for set 0, for I equals 32, we access set 0 to bring in array of 4k. And you might say, well, do we access that again? And the answer is no. So I gave a bad example because I forgot that there's no reuse here that we actually get useful work out of. Well, I guess, so the first case where we might have reuse. So these are all misses except if we have the same value access, same block access twice. So our first candidate for that is array of 128. Does that make sense? Because array of 128 was accessed, array of 128 is accessed when I equals 1, and for B, and accessed when I equals 128 for A. So our question is, for that value, can we have a hit when we access it for A? And we look at this pattern here, and we say, well, that's set 64. And my pattern says that set 64, I didn't access in between, so that's going to be a hit for A. So a hit for A, and also we access set 64 when I equals 129, so that's a hit. And we can keep doing that pattern for each of the other values. With this access pattern, it's a little awkward to figure out where we get the pattern, because this is what I get for making up an example. So then we have array 256 is set 128 because I 128, and we access this when I equals 2 for B and for I equals 128 for A, and we don't know, there's nothing in between, or wait, okay. I can't read my own chart. So, this array 128 was set with 64. And if we look up here, we access set 64. When I equals 1 for B, we get array 128. When I equals 33 for B, we get array 128 plus 4k for B. When I equals 65, we get array 128 plus 8k for B, and so on. That means when we have this potential to access array 128 again, it's going to be a miss. Does that make sense? Because I know from this pattern, when I looked at when do I access set 64, I have other accesses. It's a direct map cache. There's only one slot. So that's always a miss by the time we access it for the first access. And going up to here. So. Question?
So is the idea like you're just trying to find out like for a given I, like if the read and the write are going to be inserted, rather than the cache?
So you want to find out for a given set, when do we read and write to that set? And we want to say when we have a chance for a hit. So I guess the thing I didn't mention is, remember, chances for hits are repeated accesses to same block. And here are repeated accesses to the same block. We have two types. So two types of repeated accesses. We have the accessing array of I and array of I plus 1 when they're in the same block. So those are going to be hits. So half our accesses to A, which means roughly half our accesses to A, sys to A are hits. We also have accessing array of I and array of I and then I times 128 and then accessing array of I when I prime equals I times 128. Does that make sense? So accessing something like I equals 1, 128 here, versus when we get to iteration 128 of the loop. So that's the other candidate. And these turn out to be misses mostly, at least mostly, because we have other accesses mostly to the same set in iterations in between. And what we want to do to analyze the accesses, we want to look at each of these candidates we want to figure out where do we access the same block repeatedly, and then say, given what sets are being accessed, what the pattern looks like, what can happen. And we can see that when we go through this analysis, if we finish the analysis for array of 128, 256, and so on, we'll find out that I believe that the accesses to B that we've listed up here, this pattern, is going to mean that every time we would have had a chance that we read that later value in the array, it's not going to be there anymore because of other conflicting accesses. And I'm sorry for kind of fumbling this. Probably should have tried harder to make a simple example, since this is way more complicated than I would like to ask on the final. Yeah?
Can you briefly explain what right not allocate, how is that function?
The reason I said right through right not allocate is that when I is 0 here, or I guess 0 isn't the interesting case, when if we have a conflict between, like when I is 128, so if I was a value where array of I and array of I times 128 conflicted, map to different blocks but conflicted, we'd have to worry about, do I have a miss for the right? Maybe I read array of I, read array of I times 128, evicting array of I, and then try to write array of I, and I wanted to avoid the issue of whether that mattered. And that's how that would affect things. Because if it's write through, write no allocate, we don't care if it's in the cache, we're always writing through. It doesn't change anything. And there's clearly, and we're generating assembly for this, you can imagine the compiler reading array of I before array of I times 128, or vice versa. It's not clear from the C code. So if we asked you where it mattered, that would be a problem. Does that make sense? Maybe. Okay. So. Yes. But the yes. Yeah, general pattern is look for cases where we access the same block multiple times and try to see what are the accesses to the set, and way to figure that out is like what set numbers are being accessed each iteration. So you can easily say, I know it's to this set, what iterations do I need to care about of the loop? Anything? Okay, so next question was about code optimizations. So what are loop unrolling, are good when? So loop unrolling is that we take a loop and we remove loop overhead. And loop overhead equals instructions to manage the loop index, instructions to check whether we're done with the loop. And the advantage, you know, so the advantage is if the loop overhead was slowing us down, which often it was. But it, for example, wouldn't be an advantage, you know. So usually, yes, it is. Example where it wouldn't is if we had really slow cache accesses that were executed in parallel. So if we, like, our loop has some loads, those loads on an out-of-order processor will occur completely in parallel with the actual execution of, like, adding to the loop index, and the loop unrolling might not matter in that case, for example. Because even though we're running less instructions, those extra instructions don't take any extra time, we just run them at the same time as we're waiting for this really long load. So, and there's a case where loop unrolling is negative, and that's the disadvantage is that it means the program has more instructions. So more space in the instruction cache. If our program is big, maybe we run out of space. Another disadvantage is that we might run extra code if the number of loop iterations is very small. Because our unrolling assumed we'd usually do groups of, you know, k, or equals how much we unrolled. But so if we end up doing less than k, we're probably going to run more code to, like, check, is it k, or are we doing k things, or, like, and to handle that it's not, groups of k aren't a good idea. So for function inlining, we remove function overhead. And the function overhead is instructions to manage arguments, return values, stack variable, stack the stack, I guess return address, the stack, and callee caller saved requirements. So if those are taking up a lot of time, function inlining is good. So advantage if the function overhead was slowing us down, and disadvantage again is larger number of instructions in instruction cache. And I guess I should be clear, when I say the program has more instructions in the executable file, not more times we fetch an instruction. Those are different things. When we run the program, we'll fetch less instructions with either of these. Okay. So those are the sort of first order benefits and disadvantages of function inlining and loop unrolling. Sort of second order benefits of function inlining and loop unrolling is that they expose other optimizations. So an example was, you know, function inlining might make it possible to eliminate common sub-expressions between function calls. Now that you know what the function does when you're optimizing the single thing what was previously called from. now that we don't make it, I guess, easier, now that we don't need to look across multiple functions to do it, we, or compiler, or example, loop unrolling is a prereq for doing multiple accumulators or vector instruction, or most uses of vector instructions. Yeah.
What do you mean by sub expression?
So for example, let's say, for example, RIDX was a function, what do I mean by a sub expression? I'll just answer that directly. So common sub expression are parts of expressions that are the same. So for example, given, you know, x plus y times x times z plus y and x times z plus w, x times z is a common sub-expression. A common compiler optimization compute x times z once. If you have a loop which like contains both of those, and the compiler can tell x and z aren't changed.
So is the logic with function inlining then that if the function has a sub-expression, it wouldn't be
that
would involve the common sub-expression because it's being in different calls, but if you inline, then
yeah,
it would,
it's you know, easier because you have to look less far to find the common sub-expressions. Not because there's something stopping you from doing it in general, but yeah. The sub-expression wasn't the function, yeah. It's easier, it's kind of necessary because you have to change the function call to something inline and to take advantage of it if it's in the function, if the expression's in the function, right? Because we can't just call the function and expect the code to change to store stash this thing that for all our call happens to be repeated. So these are the kinds of things where being inlining it, it permits us to do this optimization where basically we're saying the way we're using the function here, we can do something special with. And the compiler can take advantage of that when you manually inline the function or it inlines the function, which it couldn't do otherwise. And this is often often the real advantages of function inlining, there will be some part of it which is removing the function call overhead, but a lot of it which will be that it allows other optimizations to happen. And I guess a concrete example is in the smooth assignment, when the compiler inlines the parts of the average function, it can often figure out that you're dividing by 9 when it does its inlining, which obviously it wouldn't know in general. But to do that, it has to inline it. It can't change the original average function to hard code a 9. Yeah. Can I go over cache blocking? I'll add that to the list at the end of what I already have. And this should go with my virtual memory set. Okay, so vector instructions, Q8, spring 2016, right? I need to call up the exam. I should probably look at the key version, so I am less disturbed by Q8. Okay, so the question was that we had a loop and it had an instruction like this. And the question was, what does And the question asserted that, so this was not only about, do you want to know, person who asked this, do you want to just know about vector instructions for this?
I want to know why that answer, because the description that answer, I was kind of why that
answer. Okay, so when we, yeah, so can't use vector instructions for this. So there's a couple problems with it. So one problem is, how do we load bi divided by 2 bi plus 1 divided by 2? So if we use vector easily because of aliasing. But let's talk about, you know, generally using vector instructions for this. And all I'm going to say, let's say our vectors contain two integers just so I have to write less. So if we're using vector instructions for this, we're going to turn this into something like, instead of I plus equals 1, we're going to turn this into I plus equals 2. And AI plus 1. So we wanted to turn this into vector instructions. So we have an issue with aliasing. We also have an issue here with how do I load these two elements of B. But let's say we can figure out a good solution for that. We might be able to observe that if we're only doing two elements per vector, maybe they're always the same thing, or we just check if it's even or odd, offset. So that just works. But here we have the issue that if I do these, that I can't actually, that when I use vector instructions, I'm going to end up doing something like this. End up with doing something like temp 1 equals AI. Temp 1 plus equals AI minus 1 times BI divided by 2. And the same thing for temp 2, but for AI minus, or AI is 1, so on. So when I do vector instructions, I'm going to end up with vector code that's equivalent to this, where temp 1, 1, 2 represent parts of a vector register. Because I'm going to load AI and AI plus 1, I'm going to do the plus equals on them, and then I'm going to store these results. And the problem is what if AI and BI plus 1 divided by 2 are the same element? In that case, here, I would have seen this change to BI plus 1 here, this B value here, but I wouldn't see it with my natural vector instruction implementation, which basically has temporary variables for all the A's until it finishes the computation of all of them. Does that make sense? So the previous code updated AI here, which meant that if updating AI also updated BI plus 1 divided by 2, then we would see that result for temp 2 in the computation of temp 2, and therefore AI plus 1. But that won't happen with the vectorized code, because we'll load this temp 1 and 2 is one vector register that we have to load all together and do all the computation together. We can't interleave the loads and stores anymore. So the compiler, in order to vectorize this code, would need to prove that A and B don't overlap in a way which would allow this to happen. And most likely a way a compiler would do that is would like generate both versions of the code and have a test to see which one to use. But it's not going to do that unless it's pretty confident, because now you're making your file much bigger in a way which won't work if typically that test fails. So, questions? And vector instructions in general, so, you know, they single instruction, multiple data might be a better way of remembering it. Same thing on pairs of data, on pairs, groups of matching data. So typically we have, you know, vector equals little array, vector instruction acts on several arrays, same operation on element 0, element 1, element 2, etc. So same thing for each of the element numbers of the array. And the, you know, writing vector instructions, you know, is that we typically, you know, unroll and try to have groups of vector size identical things. You know, don't want to have to worry about dependencies between them, because we'll do them all in parallel. So the previous example was an example where we had a potential dependency, and that would make it hard because we're going to do all of them at the same time. We don't want to have to wait for the previous result to use the next, and don't want to have conditionally different operations, because that's going to make things harder. How do we make that conditional happen only sometimes? We want to really do the exact same thing for each of the values. Okay, and okay, Q4. So Q4 of Spring 15. Oh, these are. So the description I have here, mapping program accesses to physical addresses, does not see, oh, does, okay. So, oh, yeah. Okay, so the person who asked me to go over Q4, yes. So first of all, maybe something which confused people is that this is, the question talks about physical addresses only because we're dealing with, the previous part talks about using a TLB, and this part, it doesn't have virtual memory at all. So I guess the reminder is, you know, not, you know, accesses to physical addresses. Remember, caches typically you are based on physical addresses. So if you care about the cache access, otherwise it's a cache simulation problem is all it is. Does that make sense? And the other part's the part which is different. Question three. Okay, so virtual memory lookup with multi-level page tables. So the high level, and I guess this gets over interleaved, we'll do the calculating sizes since that information will be helpful for our multi-level lookup. So generally, the number of bits used to index into a page table is going to be equal to the size of the part of the VPN used. You know, for a single level table, number of bits used equals size of bits in VPN. For a multi-level table, VPN, well, the bits in VPN are divided between, in VPN are divided between the levels of the table. And typically evenly, but maybe not. You know, typically evenly, but sometimes that's not possible. Like if we have 13-bit VPNs and a two-level table, well, not going to be even. We can't really do that. And number of bits to index page table, you know, implies that there's two to the that number page table entries. And this means that you can say two to the number of bits to index times the PTE size equals the page table size. So you can use that, solve that formula for whatever variable you're missing and figure it out. So if you know the page table size and the number of bits to index, you can figure out the page table entry size by dividing both sides by two to the number of bits to the index and get that answer. So that's that. And similarly, if you want to know the bits in VPN, so a virtual address is a VPN part and the page offset part. So if you, so the bits in virtual address equals bits in VPN plus bits in page offset. So if you know any member of that, you can solve for the other one. Or maybe pictorially might be simpler to think about. And similarly, a physical address equals a PPN and a page offset, which might be a different size. And the bits in the physical address are the bits in the PPN plus the PO. You can solve for that. And this means that if you don't know the page offset size, but you know something about the physical address, that might help you find the page offset size, which might help you find out more things about the virtual address. Also, so page table sizes, you know, must be big enough for at least the physical page number plus the valid bit, and probably more. So if you want to know like what a minimum page table entry size is, you have to at least be able to store the physical page number. If you can't, you don't have the right size. And you also need a valid bit, at least. Okay. So the virtual memory lookup with multi-level tables. So we take the VPN from the address, which is the first number of bits, see above, and we're going to split the VPN into parts, split the VPN into parts depending on table sizes and number of levels. So you're going to have a number of parts equal to the number of levels, and the sizes of those parts will depend on the table size. If they're all the same, well, you're just going to divide up the VPN evenly. If that's not possible, you'll have to do something else and need information about what decision to make. And take the, you know, first, I guess you say first, the most significant bits. So take the most significant part used to find index in first level table. And this means that the address you check is start of table plus index times PTE size, just like accessing an array in C. When you access an array of T, you take the start of the array, you add the index multiplied times the array element size. You know, array of PTEs. So PTEs are our array element. And repeat, so use PTE from first level table to get a page number, a physical page number that tells you where the second level table is, and look and set, take the second most significant part and use to index in the second level table, and you check start of table plus index plus times PTE size. A nit here is that the start of table is, you know, given as a physical page number in the PTE, not a byte address. So you need to convert. Might need to convert. And you convert a page number to a byte address by just adding a page offset, and you want to start at the beginning of the page, so all zeros. And repeat until you've run out of levels. Repeat until you've run out of levels. Last entry, last PTE you find gives the physical page number that goes in the final physical address. Does this make sense? Questions?
Sort of off topic, is the final exam gonna be like pretty much an even split between exam 1, 2, and 3 material?
The exam will probably be slightly more than half post-exam 2 stuff. Yeah.
So does the PTE from the first level give you the offset?
What? The it doesn't give you the offset?
No. What does it give you? So can you just take the last MS part and go directly to the
left? So use the PTE. So we looked up. We take the most significant part. I should say MS is most significant part. And you find a page table entry. That page table entry, like all page table entries, has a valid bit and a physical page number. That physical page number tells you where the set next table is. Is that what you, I don't know, sure what you were confused about. Yeah.
For the second level, why are we multiplying by page table entry size again?
Because the index we get from the address, because the index we get in the original address is still the number of the virtual page of the which entry element in that array of page table entries. It's not like there's no adjustment, like the virtual address doesn't have like extra zero bits to account for the page table entry size. It just has indices, and we have to adjust for however big our page table entry is. So, for example, like if the index is 10, I want the 10th page table entry. I don't want to go 10 bytes in and get something in the middle of the page table entry. So, other questions, comments? Yeah.
For the second level, should it multiply page table entry size or page table size?
So for the second level, the index is always multiplied by the page table entry size. Always, always. The reason why you're probably thinking of the page size is that we got a page number from the page table entry, and if you're going to use that as a byte address, you need to convert it from a page number to a byte address. So the page number is not a full address yet, right? It's missing the page offset, so you need to add a page offset, and then a page offset is going to be all zeros. That's the same thing as multiplying by the page size, adding those zeros. So what you call multiplying by the page size is a step we saw in the diagrams. I'm just expressing in a different way as converting from a page number to an address, to a byte address. Yes?
So the page table entry size just measured by the number.
So the page table entry size measured in bytes? Generally, yes, because we address our memory in bytes. So we have to give a byte number where the page table entry is. We addressed our memory in some other way, we measure the page table size that way. Page table entry size that way. Yeah?
Can you explain again, how do you get the index at the very beginning?
How do I get the index at the very beginning? So we take our virtual page number, so we figure out what part of the address that is, and the most significant bits of that are where we're going to find the index for the first level table. How many bits we take depends on the table size, and we need some information to know that. Like most commonly, we'll split up the virtual page number evenly between the levels. But like if we have a 13-bit virtual page number, obviously we aren't doing that. Okay, so next issue, TLB hit versus miss. So TLB hit means we can skip the page table lookup because we have a copy of the page table entry we get at the end saved from earlier. A TLB miss means we have to do the page table lookup. It may or may not succeed. Whether when we have a TLB miss, we don't know. May not result in a valid page. So maybe we'll find out, yep, there was a page there and move on. Maybe we'll find out, no, there wasn't. That it's a TLB miss doesn't tell us what the outcome of the in-memory access actually is. It just tells us that it wasn't as fast as it could have been because we didn't save a copy of the page table entry from earlier. And someone asked about cache blocking, which I'll move back up here as sort of the is good when. Same question. So cache blocking is good. You know. So cache blocking, reorder memory accesses to reduce, you know, so to increase the amount of reuse close in time. Time space. And this is basically, or another way is reorder memory accesses to increase locality, both temporal and spatial. This is what it does, and the mechanism is divide input matrices into blocks, work, try to keep block accessed repeatedly, and this is better spatial locality, blocks adjacent elements within block used together in time, and better temporal locality use parts of block repeatedly before moving on to next block. And we're doing the same calculation, we're just reordering the calculation in order to make this reuse both using things that are close together, close in time, and using a value that we use multiple times during the calculation, close in time, by working on these blocks, we're making that better. So it's useful only if you have a calculation which, you know, actually reuses values at some point. Like if you don't ever reuse values in this sort of pattern where you can take advantage of accessing them, doing the things repeatedly, not going to really help you. Uses values, I guess I should say values or at least cache blocks. So if you think about rotate, cache blocking really helped, and it really helped because we were using different parts of the same cache block. We wanted to make sure we got that. But if we did the natural thing, we had bad spatial locality. If you do cache blocking, you had better spatial locality. The reuse was not that individual pixels were used multiple times. We only touched each pixel once. The reuse was that cache blocks were used multiple times. And rearranging the code to take advantage of that would give you a big performance boost. Actually uses, I should say, yeah, cache blocks. That's important. So it reused, so that calculation, when we're reading from source or writing to desk, we reuse cache blocks. We access the same cache block multiple times in the original code, very different iterations of the loop. So cache blocking helped prevent that. So it's useful, and sort of the disadvantage is that if cache performance wasn't the problem, then now your code becomes more complicated and therefore slower. Slower, just more loop overhead. So like if you do cache blocking and everything fits in the cache already, well, all you've done is add some extra logic to arrange your computation in a way where now you have more complicated array indexing. So that could hurt you. Okay, so I think I'm over time. So I'll have these notes posted and the recording